medications, and any containment devices that might be necessary for them. For larger animals and livestock that you can't take with you, just don't leave them in barns. Let them out to pasture in open meadows if possible for the best chance of survival. A large animal shelter has been established at Camelot Equestrian Park at 1985 Clark Road in Paradise. Animals are being accepted between 7 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. The number is 530-895-0000. Again, that number is 895-0000. If you are a senior citizen needing affordable housing, applications for admission to the wait list are being accepted at Jarvis Gardens, 2001 Notre Dame Boulevard in Chico. Jarvis Gardens Senior Apartments is a 49-unit apartment complex for seniors whose head of household, co-head of household, or spouse is 62 years of age or older. For more information, call the facility at 345-1385. For KZFR 90.1 FM, I'm Matt Fidler, reporting from Chico.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, we'll be talking about traditional ecological knowledge.
This is KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological.
In this program, we'll be talking with Allie Metters-Knight, a member of the Machupta tribe. She's an artist, activist, and educator. This is part of our series on radical change. We'll ask her how traditional ecological knowledge can be a radical change from Western traditions of treating the land.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Corona Conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets on Wednesday mornings at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday mornings at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico. The Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. We want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. We'll take a brief break and be back to talk with Ali Meter tonight about traditional ecological knowledge. is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Our guest this afternoon is Allie Meters Knight, a member of the Machupta tribe and an artist, activist, and educator. Allie has a vision to educate residents of Butte County in traditional ecological knowledge. She'll explain what that knowledge is and how it will transform how we live on and treat the land. Welcome, Allie.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to have you.
Before we begin talking about traditional ecological knowledge, could you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you get to this point, your history, your work?
Yeah, so I'm a Machupta tribal member, and in 1995 when I was about 20, or 1998 when I was about 24 years old, I began learning how to weave a traditional Maidu utilitarian basket. And so this was one of the first skills that I learned through this traditional cultural camp through the Machupta Indian tribe. I was kind of young. I'm 45 now. So then when I was 24, I had to go out and get the materials after I learned how to weave on my own. And that whole journey embarked me on learning about TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, and how to do large land management so that you could get good basket materials, but also the health of an ecosystem, watershed, etc.
So tell us a little bit about traditional, and you've worked with children. What is your work as an educator been? I know
So Kids in Creeks was the first time. It was about 2012
right. When
I really started teaching Kids in Creeks out to Chico. That's a science outdoor education program that doesn't exist right now, but it was a great program. And so I ran a native station where a lot of children would come in, and when they would come to my station for 20 to 40 minutes, we would talk about traditional knowledge of the land, plants, how these plants were used, what seasons they were gathered, and basically the keystone species in the area and how to maintain them.
Actually, I'm supposed to give you regards from my daughter-in-law, Samantha Zangrilli, who worked with you in Kids and Creeks. where did that lead you in doing that kind of teaching? Had you already learned that before you had to teach it, or did you have to learn it in order to teach it?
It was one of those serendipitous opportunities that kind of come in our community when just anyone's curious and they call the Machupta Indian tribe and said, can someone come in and talk to the students about the Machupta tribe? So a lot of times it's just a lot of educators and teachers doing outreach, trying to get the students and the community involved in knowing and hearing from the horse's mouth, so to speak, what this information is about. So once I had to fulfill that, it pretty much put me through a portal of a journey that I'm still in.
Nice. So tell us what traditional ecological knowledge, it's TEK, what is that? How is it derived, and how is it passed on?
So traditional ecological knowledge, TEK, is actually a system of ecological science and technology developed by indigenous people over 20,000 years. So what that basically means is there's a science that was here before Western science. It's an indigenous science, pretty much based on observation of landscapes, wildlands, and it's place-based knowledge. And so, that's been kind of where I started to learn how to get the basket materials and how to take care of them, and when to gather them, how to gather them, where to cut, when to cut, and how to propagate, where to put them, where they would survive, all those things. I would just basically each one teach one. And so traditional ecological knowledge has become almost a science class, especially in this community, based on place-based knowledge of indigenous people here.
So did somebody teach you that? How did you learn it? How did you come upon that knowledge?
So back then, TEK was pretty much not a word found except in prescribed firing, where fires were used, where they were trying to get traditional burning in California used, and they were using a term, traditional ecological knowledge. So I looked around, I Googled it, I didn't really find a lot about it. So that I put in 2009, I went and I started to collaborate, and then finally, I think it was 2014, when I finally was able to put a Earth Day summit type convention at Chico State called Indigenous Earth Relations Alliance, where we had professors and pretty much students come on Earth Day to talk about TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, and whether this was something that we were going to pursue further as even ethnic studies or something that we could do on top of just being a Native American, getting a degree minor in Native American studies, that it would have to do with some of the TEK, traditional ecological knowledge of place-based knowledge of how plants and keystone species interacted. And that convention, that sparked the local support. And so I went around and found out that tribes across the United States are using TEK, and they're using it through a stewardship contracting for federal land.
So is that knowledge, you said it's place-based, so that means each tribe has developed traditional ecological knowledge for their own region and their own place. How is that communicated? How is it? I'm interested in how this knowledge is passed along, how people get it, and how it's passed along.
So we have, and you have to talk right what's in their face, is that California Natives did go through a democratically imposed genocide at the beginning of the onset of California. So in 1850s, California citizens and the governor issued bounties for the lives of every Native person that wasn't working on ranches.
Mm-hmm.
So this really, this political genocide that took place in California is something that we really want to say, then how did you learn past that? How did you get what you know after all that?
Mm-hmm.
And so to answer that question, a lot of the knowledge wasn't lost. And so what was saved was keystone species for land management based on traditional items that were saved and made from. So baskets, there's not a lot of basket weavers going on now, but baskets are considered a technology. Mm-hmm. And the technology and basket weaving extends to the land, to the plant, to the watershed, and then to the place. And so that knowledge is in basket weavers. A lot of master weavers have that. And so when the technology like basket weaving is saved, it's you know, ironically and maybe not, but connected and woven into everything else. So it is essentially the rabbit hole that you go down. And then once you start finding that, you find traditionalists that know plants, traditionalists that that do hunting, traditionalists that make items for cultural dances, and belts and such. So that cordage and things, and those types of things are technologies. So that's how you basically extract them. But you also have to protect them. It's not something that you want to solicit if you can understand the beginning of how this is explained through genocide. And it's, I don't want to exploit something precious that's been survived to so much trauma, but I want to appreciate it and bring it back in the true nature that it was designed in.
Right. We want to ask a little bit about the principles and how they differ from Western scientific management. But I wanted to mention, I was just rereading Howard Zinn's People's History of the U.S., and he talks about the fact that when colonists came to Virginia, they didn't realize that the Native Americans had established the entire colony of Virginia as a massive food forest. And the colonists just, they were used to planting things in rows and didn't realize that the Native Americans had managed the forest to provide all kinds of food. So that's one illustration of the difference in conception. But could you talk a little bit, please, Holly Matters Knight, about how Native American practices differ from typical scientific so-called management of our forests?
Well, I think you can start first on just how they're classified. So Western science systems, you know, they're in species cataloging, plant morphology. These are specific areas where people areas that the outcomes of studying these are not for the betterment. There is no high, it doesn't deliver to a higher good of health or ecosystem.
Uh-huh.
It's just the basic studying of it in itself. And then while it does that, while it just studies itself and knows itself, you know what I mean, which is just a beautiful thing in some ways, being so self-aware. But there's really no outcome. There's no relationship. So the symbiotic relationship in an ecosystem is based on human management when it comes to TEK. And so it makes the human the good guy, where in Western science, human can be the bad guy. It's a good cop, bad cop scenario when you come to TEK versus Western science. Western science, the bad cop, and he's going to nail it to you. He's going to give you all the codes and restrictions and laws and things. And then you're going to have a good cop with TEK that's kind of understand your relationship to the place and what's really going on and really wants to listen to you and have a beneficial relationship. Bueno, bueno.
Right.
So, and so that... that is a rough kind of but really direct explanation of the difference of the two. Unfortunately, because of racial biases and some of the way that our institutions are set up in education, TEK is not respected or right. looked at as a science and what is done basket weaving as a technology.
Right.
It looks as though it kind of still has this romanticized painting of Native Americans being able to manage the forest in a very Henry David Thoreau type transcendental way.
Uh-huh.
And the relationship is a lot more laborious and a lot more intuitive and long-lasting through generations.
So can you describe that a little bit more, the land management process of indigenous people, and especially because it's really important now, how they're climate adaptive, how that's superior to the way others have managed the land.
Yeah, I gotcha. So to describe the land management process of most indigenous peoples is kind of like it's actually mimicking their years of climate adaptation, because indigenous people for years have had to adapt to climate change, but not man-made climate change, you have to understand. There's been climate change because of volcanoes. There's been climate change because of other environmental things going on the planet while humans were inhabiting the planet. But what we're experiencing now is a man-made one. But Native folks have gone through natural ones for thousands of years. So adaptation, say, to this valley area, for example, is that Machupta people lived in the marshlands and down here in the valley during the winter and the cooler months. And then in the heat, they would go up to the higher altitudes and live in the shade and the valley oaks,
mm-hmm.
where it was relatively cooler. So for climate change adaptation now, what I am promoting and what I think is important is that we have 800,000 acres of federal forest just alone in Butte County, and it's sitting like a matchbox.
Mm.
And what we have to do for climate adaptation is to get communities who live in these areas, who live in these federal forests, but work in the federal forest and have a community there, but they actually design the community to be a benefit to that ecosystem and not the bad cop laying down the laws and doing whatever they got to do to make it work. You have to be more adaptive. It cannot be an assimilation type process when you're doing TEK and forestry. You're going to have loggers who know how to cut down trees, but then you're also going to have people that know how to put trees down and maintain areas and say, it's time to burn here, a small, light, smoky burn, which only does a couple acres at a time, rather than having lightning come in, wreak havoc everywhere, or people don't even understand the landscape. If you actually worked on those areas and worked in those forests long enough, you would get around quicker and have a lot more mindset of what's happening when things are a crisis is going on in that forest. But it all seems like a dark, deep hole, like the abyss. And so when lightning hits there, only we just trust that the firefighters and park rangers know. But I think that's just a little bit too much pressure. We have to be involved as a community. We have to have all hands on deck.
So traditional ecological knowledge is place-based, but it's also all over. How big an organization is this, and how wide is the tribal use of passing along or teaching about or making use of traditional ecological knowledge? What's going on, and do you know what's going on in other places?
So what it is that when you have land management that takes place in Indian country or in Indian territory, a lot of it is restorative work after a natural disaster, whether it be a hurricane, earthquake, and in this case with the campfire in Paradise, there was cultural monitoring that took place after the fire. So when you have this relationship with tribal territory, there also are contracts that go through, for land management, tree removal, fuel reduction, fire safe land management, that type of things. And they're contracting these projects out to companies and people that have zero relationship to this place. Mm. They don't live here. Mm-hmm. They're not even from California. And they come in and they handle their job and they move on. But as a tribal member who's been working and studying TEK since 2009 and really pushing it to the community, I've attracted my tribe to entertain, and which they are strongly, and I'm promoting still to the community, that we should be doing TEK certifications for land management. And what this also does is, because I'm looking at stewardship contracting with the federal government, then what's important is that we could also qualify for sole source contracting, which is 638 contracting, so that we don't have to compete with people across the nation to manage our own land. And with this TEK certification from a federally recognized tribe, you could probably be eligible for a 638 contract for federal land management, as long as we have an MOU and partnerships in place.
I want to get into more detail about that and break that down a little bit more in the second half of the show. But I know you also have other cooperative efforts going on locally. I read on your webpage that you're working with the city of Chico as well.
Yeah, so Verbena Fields is on Verbena Lane and East First Avenue in Chico. And that park in 2008 was a proposed kind of renovation spot. It kind of got run down, used as a local dump, parties, four-wheeling, just kind of stuff that gets neighbors fired up at 2:00 in the morning. So they're doing a full restoration project, and I got involved, and we started partnering with Chico State, City of Chico, and the Michoacán Indian Tribe. And so with this alliance, we've been able to do workshops. Students can go up there and get hours filled on certain projects. Right now we have CAVE, which is a project at Chico State University. So we'll be having students being able to work once a week out there for 3 hours a week and get credits, really just doing land management and learning some of these TEK skills that we have. And I have a small program and station set up. So this is in you know, in cooperation with the city of Chico. But the city of Chico also has contracted someone to do a fuels management assessment on all the parks in Chico. And
oh,
I've been
wow.
able to get recognized in Verbena Fields and other work to do TEK, traditional ecological knowledge, for land management and the city of Chico parks. And so there's a lot.
Yeah. It sounds really exciting. So what's the goal with Verbena Fields? Is it, are you restoring it with native plants, or does there need to be burning there, or what, or is it just mainly cleaning it up?
It's pretty clean. It's not, it's maintained to the part where the cleaning up has to do with like star thistle and kind of like forest garbage in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really looking at, we have to do some burning in urban interface. And so this is going to be quite a challenge to introduce, burning and fire back into these areas. We have deer grass that can be drip torched and burned in seconds and doesn't really cause a lot of hoo-ha, these techniques would be used in someone's yard as well. There's going to be, a small amount of burning that's going to be necessary out in these areas. And we're trying to get the community a little bit abreast that this is going to be something that they can come out of their homes for and help with. We can all stand in a big circle around it with rakes mm-hmm. and do this together.
Mm.
This is not something that we can watch and be horrified with. If you have a concern, please grab your rake and come out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this should be something kids should be able to get ice cream and maybe hot dogs served. We should make this a community event so that we can celebrate these land management techniques, because we do live in fire country.
Right.
Just like when we know we're in Hawaii, we're in volcano country. This is fire country. So we have to acculturate ourselves to how this land has been set up for us for thousands of years. There's just no way we could fit here any other way.
How big is Verbena Field?
No, I don't even know. Verbena Fields is a few acres. It's not very big. Mm-hmm. 17 acres. It's got a lot of interpretive plaques of how the watershed was restored. It's like an overflow. And
yes.
So we've also restored a lot of habitat. Unfortunately, the Rio Lindo Channel has zero water half the year, if not more than half the year now. So a lot of these restorative practices have been modified, and I'm trying to put drought-resistant plants in so that we could, manage
restore.
It and without water.
Right.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. We're talking with Allie Meters-Knight about traditional native ecological practices. We'll take a short break and be back to talk about efforts to engage the community more about traditional ecological knowledge. This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. We're on the phone with Allie Meters-Knight. She's a member of the Machupta tribe, an artist, activist, and educator. We're talking about traditional ecological knowledge.
Shortly before COVID-19, you launched a project to teach TEK to residents of Butte County. I heard yours and Mel Figueroa's talk at the local Bioneers film series. Can you tell us about what your vision was for these workshops? What are you trying to do with these workshops? What do you hope to accomplish?
The goals of TEK, the first beginning of the training, is to kind of get everybody into knowing the cultural keystone species. So the plants and animals that play a crucial role in maintaining the ecosystem here in Butte County and in our ecological zones. So these are like culturally significant species that that I can also introduce as food or medicine, and kind of flatter or entertain the idea of a local economy based on our ecosystems and what we have here.
So what are some of those keystones?
When I'm teaching it, this goal is to kind of get a workforce development going. So the real vision is to do workforce development and community land management standards, and create a whole new professional labor force in Butte County that manage lands in a whole different way and have whole different outcomes, and actually not only create economy through the workforce, but create economy through goods for services.
That's huge. That's a lot. So what are some of those keystone species that we have in Butte County that can be developed or drawn upon, or what's the word I'm looking for?
Exploited.
Yeah. So, you know, the first lesson that I had five keystone species that mm-hmm. I introduced. So the first training was kind of going in through California mugwort, which mm-hmm. we use traditional name, Moonmoonie. California mugwort is like what they call Douglas sagewort. Moonmoonie is in a riparia zone. Moonmoonie is an insect repellent, and it really is good about keeping pests away. And the leaves are really good for burning, for getting mosquitoes away.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a great replacement for your star thistle. It's very competitive, and it does pretty good in some of the areas. It can be invasive, so you have to manage it like anything. But it's found along the Pacific Coast. It's a kind of a riparian at 7,200 elevation. So we go over, and that's kind of the basic. We just go over the base. So we go and find the mugwort on there, talk about it, then we plant it. So you see different stages of it. Here's a big mama plant, here's a baby plant, and here's the seeds. And this is at its stage when it's seeding, and this is how you get the seeds. So that's kind of how the TEK goes for just one plant.
I'd like to hear about more of this because it's really interesting. We are growing mugwort, and it's really suffering from the heat and lack of water right now. But I've used it with sage in smudge sticks.
So it is used for sage. It's also used for dreams. It's considered something for, you know, sleeping, like hops, you know, a dreamy plant. Of the dreams, but it also can be broken down into a mead, and so mugwort in England is often used for mead and alcohol and beer, and so it's one of those products that grow rapid here, and we produce it. It's a product that, you know, I don't know, Sierra Nevada might be interested in doing a mugwort-based, I'm throwing it out there, mead. Based on this traditional ecological knowledge, with an agreement with the tribe, kind of knowing that this is part of our environment, this is part of our ecosystem and our ecology as well as our economy.
And so you first of all kind of like teach the lifestyle. Are there other plants that you're emphasizing as those kind of keystone plants? You said there are five.
Yeah, so we have red bud. We have gray pine, which, you know, is thorny, the pine nuts. That's one of the most keystone species, is pine nuts. And so a lot of folks, I really want to teach and outline that these what people call ghost pines, these thonies. These pine nuts are highly valued, and it, the product of pine nuts, the amount of nutrition and food that come out of them is so valuable for us. But unfortunately, if we don't understand that and we just see a pine and think that's not good for fire and we're going to get rid of it and we don't know where it belongs, we don't understand, and you think all pines are bad, then we're going to have a problem. So it's good to know the keystones. So this was a good pine.
Right,
the gray
right.
pines are the good ones. They're the kind of the ugly ones, you know. I call them like...
I like them.
Yeah, they're kind of ugly, you know, but they're like good providers, you know. So, you know, you gotta think about that. You know, they don't look like Christmas trees, but they're like upside down Christmas trees, but they actually provide a lot of food and substance, and we should know about that.
And they grow like crazy. We have
awesome. That's Takawi. These acorns are just amazing for food and nutrition. And not only that, but these blue oak tokawis are so good at being fire adapted and providing mushrooms and spaces for great colonies of food for a lot of humans. So blue oak tokawis are like very human friendly trees. They give a lot of food. If you go starving and you identify a blue oak, you can sit under and eat.
Yeah. Yeah, we have both blue oaks and gray pines. We're in the foothills, and the gray pines have reproduced quite well, dropped pine cones, and are growing in our front yard. So they're pretty resilient, too, right?
Yeah, these are drought resistant. I mean, these are hardy plants. This is
very
something
hardy.
That a lot of people for this certification, they just go because they actually just want to be better landscapes to the land that they have. They just want to put the right plants down. If you have land and you have a creek on it, by all means, make sure you're putting your riparian interface plants in. Why are you need to be putting your alder in and your cottonwoods, because those are slow, cool burning wood.
Mm-hmm.
You can stop a fire for hours if you line your property correctly with the right trees.
So what kinds of people are you wanting to participate in this program? And I know you, first of all, tell us how COVID has affected your plans for these workshops and, you know, what's happening now.
I mean, COVID, it pretty much threw a lot of things out of order as far as like getting investors involved, and launching this into like a bigger endeavor, basically into more of an enterprise. But since COVID had happened right at the point, most of the contracts for the campfire, Paradise Fire Recovery, went out to very, very big corporate companies, and they couldn't come out and supply the workers because of COVID. And so the project is back to square one. So,
but
it's a very complicated and frustrating, and I try not to burn out. I'm trying to push this through. But the thing that keeps me going is that the whole genesis of how this started was about outdoor education with children.
Right.
And now that we have COVID and there's a necessity that kids get an education, I'm back at that place where I have to provide for the kids because they come first. And, you know, it's like that Indian saying, what do you do when you first wake up in the morning? You feed the kids. And so this is kind of along that line where TEK COVID has made me go back to that proverb or that saying and say, what's the first thing I need to do with TEK? And I teach the kids.
Right. But you haven't given up your big plans.
Oh, no, I still haven't. But, it's tough because that's big money involved. And a lot of times that can mean that I'm working outside of my scope of partnerships, because tribes basically have been more fashioned into doing cultural monitoring around artifacts.
Right.
And so I'm pretty much breaking through on land management here in this county. It's been broken through everywhere else, and there's other places to do it. But this is a particularly challenging place, so I'm actually doing pretty good despite the issues I have.
That's great.
In my mind, there's a lot of confusion over how things can be paid for land management. We hear about, even this morning, the possibility of exporting burned logs to other countries. This is apparently a breakthrough, though I didn't fully understand what it was. But clearly, we need wood in this country. There's a lot that can be done, even with scrap wood. Talk among our state senator and representative about various kinds of recycling and energy recycling projects based on scrap wood. Does that fit in at all with TEK?
Yeah, I've been working with a partnership, a group that I actually like, and so I'll say, Sarah Institute has done a tremendously good job of collaborating and communicating with me about partnerships for biomass. With the 800,000 acres of federal land, you have also the, BLM lands here in Butte County. All of this has really no funding. And that comes out of U.S. forestry. So the funding really starts to push out of the USDA. So now we are into a whole different fashion into a farm bill. You go through a whole different U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service have kind of like, what can we do to make money out of this? And this is an opportunity for this county to kind of decolonize how it capitalizes on the situation. And so instead of going, okay, we're going to turn these into rows of trees that we chop down and sell and suck every nutrient out of the soil and not pay attention to anything else, that is so primitive and undeveloped concept of land management that it's freshman in its truest definition. And I'm going at this and saying, look, we can do biomass, we can do energy infrastructures and grids within these areas and communities where we're building workforce development. And yes, we have 800,000 acres of fuel. We will be fine. We don't need to worry about destroying. We need to send these things out. So I am all down for biomass. I am all down. So 180,000, I just said 800,000. 180,000 acres. I did that. my brain just...
Going too fast.
180,000 acres of federal forest. Please, I correct myself. I just came out, I'm looking at a big painting. But the idea is that with this 180,000 acres of federal forest, we could definitely also be looking at the pine nuts that we get, the mugwort that we get, the willow that we get. It doesn't all have to go to biomass, and we don't have to ship it out. That is a poor concept of land management to create some kind of dependency on an export when we need it. We need our own independent grids here. We don't want to have power lines up in the forest. Okay, then do your biomass energy grids and then have your workforce development feed that biomass plant for your community all day. And then you got yourself a nice working workforce village that's doing land management and saving. It's a give and take relationship that is genuinely supposed to be happening anyway. And so we really have to... we really look at biomass, but I'd rather talk to CR Institute and rather do it, keep it in the community, keep it into our economy, and don't ship it out to China. Don't ship it out of the area, because if that another area is dependent on biomass and they don't have any biomass, they're jerks.
Not to put too fine a point on it. So what are the next steps for you? What do you see? Like when COVID calms down, we hope soon, what do you see your next steps as being?
Well, I'm hoping to get land and I'm hoping to get a land trust going with folks and getting a whole admin team. This is not a project of my own. I need it to be partnership owned with and administered as a partnership, as a board, as a group. because I need as much transparency and accountability from the gate. Mm-hmm. And what's important is that we can get into land trust agreement with the tribe and do some MOU agreements and start testing whether we can do some building code switcheroos with the county and the state based on our federal land and ability, but based on our federal recognition as a tribe. So we are a sovereign, federally sovereign tribe. So I'm hoping that I can get the tribe partnered up with the city, partnered up with the county, partnered up with the land trust, and say, look, we can't have cob buildings and we can't do these building codes anywhere, but under this agreement for this land trust, we can do TEK, bids for services, do this workforce development, hire people to come in. We pretty much works almost like a job corps. You know, we have housing for families and housing for singles. And this is workforce, you know. And so you're working on base. Everybody has a job. It's almost going to look like a military base because no one's there just to live there. Everyone there is going to have a piece of the pie.
What's the age range of the people in the job training? You're going to go for young people, 17, 18 years of age?
We're going to go for everybody because there's jobs as simple as sorting acorns. And making sure acorns are good and acorns are bad. Mm-hmm. And so there's some jobs in this arena that everybody can do. I think we can go we can get a lot more elders, people with special needs and things to kind of find their niche in this type of workforce.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you have a timeline? Are you thinking about this in terms of, like, in the next 3 years, in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years?
Well, we kicked off our first workshop this spring.
Right.
And so my goal is to make another workshop this fall.
Mm-hmm.
But this workshop would entail a little bit of cost. But I need the budget for this, along with some fundraising, would go into land management to actually get housing quarters for workers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I want to kick that off in October, where there's a film coming on with TEK. And I'm kind of just trying to get this kind of going as right before I'm hopefully the change of powers in D.C.
Yeah, really. Yes. Yep. Yes. So if people want to learn more about what you're doing, what should they do?
So it's good to go on tekchico.org and get on the website and sign up for all of the upcoming events, articles, you know, if we have a film coming on, things like that. That's a good spot. It's also important to look up the information that I'm talking about. So if you can, go on to the forest site, the Federal Forest, U.S. Department of Agricultural and Federal Forest, USDA, mm-hmm. look under stewardship contracting, mm-hmm. basic stewardship concepts, and just look at the roundabout ideas of what this is about. This contracting in Butte County on federal land could bundle several contracts into one to treat one landscape. It could trade goods for services. You can retain forest products to be removed and meet a restoration object somewhere else. You know, so if you have thinning of places that need that are a rare native species, you can propagate them somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
If they're especially, we do have a lot of plants in the wrong zone, you know, like a lot of elderberry. That's not going to be there. Should be up here in this zone. That kind of thing.
Yes, I understand.
And so these are, and the big shebang about these stewardship contracting for federal land is that they're 20-year contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not short term.
Right.
So if we're talking about creating a program where we can pick up these contracting and we have a piece of land where people are living and part of the workforce, this is not a 5-year contract where, oh gosh, that's stressful, or a 7-year, gosh, that's stressful. We're talking 20 years, and that's long term. And, you know, that's, we can work with that, you know, we can definitely work with that.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about all of this, and I hope that people follow up and...
We'll put those links up on our website.
Yes, yes. Our guest has been Allie Meters Knight. She is a member of the Majupta tribe and an advocate for traditional ecological knowledge. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with all of your projects. It sounds so exciting.
Oh, thank you. Tikin, let's say hey to Nani, which is hello, and Majupta. And always, I'll never forget to tell everybody, welcome to occupied Majupta territory.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, it's Ginger Nichols with Radioactive and her music and commentary. Contact us at ecotopia@gmail.com. We'd like to hear feedback about shows, particularly suggestions for shows as part of our Radical Change series, or questions about any of the topics we've covered. Also, let us know if you have a public service announcement that will be of value to our community. And if you want to have that aired, send it along. You can listen to our previous shows and check out our list of resources. Go to our website. It's ecotopiakzfr.com. And we now podcast. You can link to our various podcast services via our website. Thanks very much for listening. Thank you.
hold the girl.